All right, so I've promised to do this for a long time. I'll finish writing some of this stuff, or y'all can help me finish writing some of this stuff. And let me make a couple caveats at the beginning of this class. What I'm about to talk about today, the entirety of this presentation, is my opinion and not the opinion of Reston Bible Church. Reston Bible Church does not have an official opinion on this because the elders of Reston Bible Church occupy multiple positions along this spectrum. It seems to me that the majority of elders at Reston Bible Church occupy a position that we would call Western, derivative of a Catholic Church, Protestant, and principally Calvinist. So that's the majority of the elders. And so if you're wondering what Reston Bible Church's official position is, it's none of this. If you're wondering what Reston Bible Church's elders' personal positions are, it's going to be this direction. I'm going to give you, in my opinion, the strongest arguments I can against that view. So you'll see what I'm unfortunately having to do is argue against the personal view of the majority of elders of Reston Bible Church. Now, it is a testimony to, I think, to the elder board here, in my opinion, to their academic openness, that they have not prohibited me from doing this. I won't say they encouraged me to do it, but I will say they haven't prohibited it. And so I respect that greatly, along with the respect which is to be tendered to the elders alone. So regardless of what the elders believe, I would believe what I'm about to show you for the reasons that I'm going to show you. But that would drive whether or not I ought to be teaching at Reston Bible Church or whether I ought to carry my belief system to another institution that believes more similarly to what I believe. So with that caveat all in place and saying I'm going to give you a quick brief background that is absolutely not anywhere close to exhaustive. It's barely superficially topical, but it should at least frame what we're talking about. Then I'm going to offer you three arguments for why the fundamental position that underlines some of this side is logically flawed. So I know a lot of people are going to want to talk scripture, and we will talk scripture in here, but the point that I'm making isn't that the scriptures cannot be interpreted this way or that they should be interpreted this way. I'm not talking about doing the theology of it. I'm talking about whether the end arguments are logically consistent or logically inconsistent. Because one of the baseline beliefs that I hold, and I think that when you get down to talking to a lot of the theologians that do this professionally, that they hold, is that God is a God of order, not of chaos, that God is a logical being, not an irrational being. And so if our... You'll see a lot of effort by the Catholic Church, by various Protestant churches, by the Orthodox Church, to ensure that the doctrines that they derive from the Scriptures are logically consistent. When they don't have logical consistency, you'll hear terms come out like, this is a mystery, or this is something we don't know, or there may be more data of which you're not aware, or man's reason is flawed and unreliable. However, I will leave it to you whether you think that those kinds of appeals are ones that ought to be made rationally or are fulfilling to you. If there is enough interest in it, this might roll in the next week, because the question that will be begged at the end of this is, if you find this convincing, you're going to say, well, how is what you're talking about here reconciled with? And there's going to be a list of probably five topics that are going to include things like God's sovereignty or God's... prior moral choice and all this stuff, or our own sin, or what is sin nature, all those kinds of things. So those will be topics that would be derivative of this class, but it's not my intent to hit those in here solely for the matter of time. We have an hour to do this. So all that being said, let me give you a quick frame, and then I'll give you the arguments, and then shoot at any point, any time that you want to. So the major debate, in my opinion, is what is the nature of what is called original sin? Now, we talk about the doctrine. We say the doctrine of original sin. There are, in fact, multiple doctrines of original sin. And the doctrine of original sin is the big topic. What did the fall do to mankind? What were the results of the fall? How did it work out? What are the moral implications? What are the nature implications? What are the implications to mankind in total? And his relationship with God. The two ends of the spectrum, in my opinion, that are the most important two ends of the spectrum, are one that is called total depravity, which is also the T of tulip of Calvinism, and free will, which I would say 90+% of Calvinists today will also affirm free will. But we'll get to how that works out in a little bit. But the bottom line is total depravity says Original sin so marred the human condition that humans cannot do the right thing of their own volition. They have to have some sort of effort by God in order to make that happen. It has been likened in the past to you are dead. You're so dead that you can't expect a dead guy to do anything. So if he's going to do anything, somebody has to innervate him and bring him back in order to do so. Free will position says you are morally equal. You have equal potential. You can do good as well as do bad in equal measure, or rather to say with equal, if not effort, with equal freedom. So there is nothing that binds you to have to do evil by necessity. If you do evil, it's because you chose to do evil. Now, I drew this on the board. If somebody on the other side were drawing it, they would not have drawn it this way. So this is my opinion as to how it all works out. So you should take this with a grain of salt. But the original three actors in all of this play, so to speak, were the Gnostics, the Manichaeans, and there are more, but these are the two major groups, and the early church. John, in his epistles, writes against Gnosticism. You'll see him hitting up kind of Gnostic topics. Manichaeanism doesn't appear to make it into the scriptures at all anywhere, nor should it, because it wasn't really there at the time. And you have early church fathers, and I'll cite several of them for you here, like Clement, who is mentioned in the scriptures as one of Paul's companions and is generally considered to be Clement of Rome. Ignatius, Polycarp, Tertullian. There are several church fathers who wrote on the topic of free will, one of whom is said by Paul to have his name written in the book of life. So that doesn't mean he's right, but at least means he seems to be orthodox according to Paul. The owner of that view, Clement of Rome, wrote very, very compellingly about free will. And I'll let you search on your own what the church fathers say. I don't want to run through it all here. But I just want to point out that ultimately, Gnostics say that the world was so evil and was in fact created by an evil being, so that your flesh is evil by nature, and the way to become good is to get out of the flesh entirely and become fully spirit. That's generally a Gnostic core belief. Now, you know, you fast forward several hundred years, a couple hundred years, a few hundred years, and there was a debate between a guy named Pelagius and a guy named Augustine or Augustine. Now, I've got Pelagius over here above the Orthodox Church. I'm not sure that the Orthodox Church would claim Pelagius as one of their own either. I'm just saying, in the spectrum of views, these two guys stood on these two sides right here. Augustine originally was a Manichaean, and he later became a Christian and was such a profound and prolific theologian that his core doctrines, the ones with which he came up, are, I would say, a lot of, if not all, in some sense, of the Catholic Church doctrine are based on the writings of Augustine. And he's recognized by people on all sides as being terrific. You will hear people say, hopefully I didn't mistakenly say this, the Orthodox Church doesn't consider Augustine a saint. That's not true. He is a saint to them, but he's not in their calendar of saints. He didn't really have much influence on the Eastern Church until really actually pretty recently. The debate here was, Can man be? Pelagius said man could be good on his own, and he could possibly live a perfect moral life. He was known for his asceticism. He was known for kind of his righteousness type of thing, but his view was condemned by a council over which Augustine presided. So, on the one hand, it's a little bit of an unfair contest because the guy who's the judge is also the guy taking the main position against this guy. And we don't really know what Pelagius believed because all of his works were burned. So all we have on what Pelagius said was what these guys said Pelagius said. So if you would be happy with your works being only known by what your opponents wrote about your works, that's the position Pelagius is in. So Pelagianism was declared heterodox. It was heresy by the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church, if you don't know the difference between the Catholic and Orthodox Church, if you run up to this kind of time, it's the East, it's the Greeks and the Roman Church. It's the Latin and the Greek Church. It's the Eastern and the Western Church. Something to keep in mind is all of us in this room, including the ones who were formerly Catholic, all come from a specific tradition that represented maybe half of the Christian view at the time. So both of these churches are really, really big about saying they trade. And by the way, the fact that the Orthodox Church is under the early church here is an artifact of Orthodox Church's view of free will, not how close their doctrine necessarily is. So this is don't read this as saying the Catholic Church is so far from the early church and the Orthodox Church has got it all right. But in the view of depravity versus free will, the Orthodox Church does not believe in a doctrine of original sin that causes total depravity. The Orthodox Church today, and has all the way through history, believes that man is morally free, and that though man's nature was changed by the fall, the way that man's nature was changed was that they became mortal rather than being immortal, and that they now live in a broken world, but that they are still morally free to choose to do the right thing or the wrong thing. Now, Augustine, obviously this is 2 centuries of church history that I've compacted into with a very little bit to say here, so not even close to everything is being said. Right. Right, good point. And by the way, there's a whole bunch of other Protestants. I just stuck Methodist out here to give you an example of folks who are more in the free will position and don't believe in the kind of total depravity viewpoint. Some interesting stuff happened here. When Martin Luther broke away, he actually thought about reaching out to the Orthodox Church and saying we should reach out to the Patriarch and reestablish. He saw better doctrine in the Orthodox Church than he did in his church at the time. Now, what he was up against wasn't this kind of doctrine. So I don't mean to say that Martin Luther believed in a free will position different than an Augustinian position. He seems to keep an Augustinian position, but to me. But the bottom line is, between these two, you can't turn around and say the Catholic Church has got it right and the Orthodox Church has got it wrong. One thing you have to ask is, on this issue, has the Orthodox Church had it right the whole time? And the Catholic Church has gone from this to, you know, I'm acting like the Catholic Church is over. It's not. Let the Catholic Church be here again. But Protestants actually fell on both sides afterwards. Calvinists went to a very rigid form, a more rigid form of holding the total depravity than even Catholics hold today. And other Protestants went all the way over to basically what the Orthodox Church's position side was, and some further, to a complete libertarian free will position that has no restraints on it, that its detractors would call a form of Pelagianism, but which other people would say that's been orthodoxy since the beginning. So I just mean to frame, I'm not laying any judgment, nor am I qualified to, on how all this works, and this is an historical and theological map. But I just want to lay out for you some things that I want to remind you of where you came from. We came from. We are children of the Western tradition, and most of us in here are actually children of a Calvinistic viewpoint. So if you're saying, when I walk into a church in America today, where do I, unless I'm walking into specifically another type of church, if you walked into RBC on this spectrum, you start right about here. That's what I mean to tell you. If Calvinism is here, RBC is here, because the majority of elders are here, and a few of them are, maybe one or two are here. But even the free will guys will say things. They'll say, no, I'm not a Calvinist. And then they will say things that are right out of Calvin. So I think sometimes we don't even know how much we are children of this. But the spectrum is broad in here. And people have made arguments that the early church fits here. And that's what I think, but I'm also representing a particular viewpoint here, so you can take that as a grain of salt, with a grain of salt. Now, I'm going to give you 3 arguments for why man is not totally depraved, why original sin did not change man's nature to a sin nature. And the reason I'm going to give you 3 arguments is because there are basically 3 reasons to believe it, and I'm going to attempt to counter each one of those reasons. So we'll start with the first one here. There's an easier way to say all this, but I'm going to give you kind of the more full version of it, the more rigorous version of it. But humans were created without a sin nature. Everybody, show of hands, who agrees with that? But you don't have to vote and all this kind of stuff, but just so you know what your own position is. Humans were created without a sin nature. Everybody here agrees with that, by the way. So this is non-controversial. We can put a check mark here. At the fall, either human nature changed or it did not change. All right, that's one of the 3 kind of fundamental laws of logic, either A or not A. Right? It is not a. That's not an option. I don't know anybody that would disagree with that one right there. Only God can change a being's nature. Now, most people don't think about this one, but You have heard me earlier in class ask this question in response to somebody else's question. If at the fall, I can only think of three candidates for who changed man's nature from this non-sin nature to what people say is a sin nature today. Who are the three candidates? God,
the devil,
and man himself. Okay? So you only got three actors in the garden at all at that time. So can the devil change man's nature? Now, what do we mean by nature? We mean something that they are essentially, that if you take that away from them, they are no longer that thing. So if you take away, like, a human being, it seems to me to be an immaterial mind and a physical body. If you took the immaterial mind away from this body, we would cease to be a human being because we are spirit or mind and body welded together. If what it means to be a cat is to be a four-legged mammal, if you took four-leggedness and being in the class mammal away from cat, what you would have would no longer be a cat because that's what it is to essentially be a cat. Right, right. It would be a different species of three-legged, some sort of new mammal, right? So it does not seem to me that the devil, and anywhere in Scripture we can come up with, has been given the power to create. And if God made a nature, does the devil have the power to come back and undo what God did and remake that being in such a way that that can logically, consistently be called the same thing?
The sin aspect of humans that we're talking about, though, I don't know that that's essential to what it means to be a human being. Right? It almost seems that a human being's tendency to sin or not sin is not an essential trait of what it means to you maybe have to be somewhere on that spectrum in order to be a human being, but being any one specific point on that spectrum would not be an essential nature.
All right, let me make a clarification here, because ultimately I think the point that you're saying is assuming what I'm trying to prove here in the long run, which is when we say somebody has a sin nature, In the definition of total depravity, if you have a sin nature, that means you sin by necessity, because you do things. When you do something by nature, you do that as a necessity of your own nature. So cats, by the necessity of their own nature, have to breathe. Why? Because a cat is an air-breathing, four-legged mammal. So being air-breathing is something that they will do as a necessity of their own nature, or very shortly they will cease to be a cat. By the same token, if God, being the ultimate being, is by nature loving, then he will love by the necessity of his own nature. So when I say by nature, I'm linking that which you do necessarily, that which you cannot choose not to do. So that's what necessity means. If we sin, total depravity says you sin as a necessity of your own nature. Another way of saying it is impossible that you will not sin. Right? So, let me finish answering his question. Sorry. If that's the definition that we're breaking out, when we say only God can change a being's nature, if humans did not have a sin nature originally, that meant that they didn't have to sin. So we're talking about going from a condition where they had the sin to did not have to sin to a condition where they had to sin. And that's what people mean by sin nature. When you talk to them, when you break it down and you say, what do you mean by sin nature? They will articulate a doctrine of total depravity that makes it clear that they mean that man has to sin. It is impossible for him not to sin. In fact, that's why Pelagius' works were consigned to the fire. As Pelagius said, you don't have to sin. You can do the right thing. And they said, that's wrong. You, by nature, by the nature of the nature that you have, by necessity of the nature that you have as a result of the fall, will do the wrong thing. So that's, I mean, to break it out in terms of necessity, that is derivative of the nature of the being. And everybody agrees that this nature was one thing, and the total depravity position is that nature has changed to another thing as a result of the fall. Does that answer your question?
Kind of, but I guess let's imagine an alternative world, right? If we're talking about possible worlds and that which is necessary and that which isn't necessary, God could have created human beings with a sin nature. Right. We might then not be in the image of God.
Ask that question in a minute, because okay. In two more propositions, you'll see me address that. Steve.
I was just wondering, how would you compare nature with instinct?
nature and instinct. So nature, when I say, if you have a nature, that will give you a set of instincts. Nature will inform those instincts heavily. Now the question is, are they things that you have to do or that result from the nature? Or are they things that you don't have to do? So it is. I think it's possible to articulate a position that says, well, you might have an instinct to sin, but your cognitive faculties, your will, whatever else, can overcome that instinct and you can choose to do one thing or another. So maybe you have an urge to do something wrong, but you have a cognitive faculty that can overcome it. That's fine. That's not total depravity. Total depravity says your cognitive faculties will not and cannot overcome your instinct, your temptation, whatever it is, even if you can say, my heart is evil and wants to do this kind of thing. But if your mind can overcome your heart, well, that's not total depravity. That's something this side of it. So I'm only arguing against the position that says you cannot do right, you have to do wrong.
This is probably a stupid question, but I'll pretend to be stupid. When was the actual fall? Because based on what you're talking about here, the choice existed before they ate the apple, right? So when was the actual fall?
Great question. Let's the one that everybody is going to, and I think that merits a lot of talking about on its own. I actually think some of the answer to the question lies in there too. Everybody here on in this part of the discussion is talking about after Eve ate the fruit and gave it to Adam, that at that time their nature was changed to a sin nature. So people would say, the theologians would say prior to that time, so even if, as Eve was considering it, her nature doesn't change.
So it's prior to that time, aren't those two making choices?
Yes, but the question isn't whether they can make choices or not. The question is whether they have a nature that causes them to sin or not.
Well, doesn't that answer itself?
No, because the question is, did the nature change at that time? And we'll follow the rest of the argument, and I'll make it a simpler version of this too, and see if that helps too. If this is a little too confusing.
Thanks, Coach.
Yeah, you bet.
Just hit the football.
Yeah, Roger that. This is football. I just need you to take it and run, man. Okay, don't let me worry about the rest of it. No, just kidding. Only God can change a being's nature is the point that I'm trying to make when I say I don't think Satan has the power to do so, and let's. So let's put Satan aside for 1 second and ask about ourselves. Can man change his own nature? If man can change his own nature and we have a sin nature, what's the solution to having a sin nature? Pop your nature right back to not having a sin nature and problem solved. So obviously we can't do that. Nor does it make sense that God could do something and create something and we can be like, hang on, creator person, I got this. And we change what he did in such a way that it changes the very nature of what we are. Now, we can change a cat and make it three-legged by amputating a cat's leg by necessity, or then you got a three-legged cat because you haven't changed the nature of the cat, because cat-ness, for those of you that are Hunger Games fans, that was not a reference, cat-ness is not something that depends on whether or not the cat ends up having three legs, but whether originally, essentially, that thing possesses the DNA that has three legs, or whether three-leggedness is what it is to be a cat. Is a matter for philosophers, but at the end of the day, I think everybody would agree you don't stop a cat from being a cat by taking off a leg.
May I? Okay. So Adam was the first man.
Yes.
Jesus essentially was the first man based on forgiveness or grace or something like this. But Jesus also said, if you even think it, you've done it.
Yeah. Well, I would say as long as you're willing to parse, I do wish to parse between thinking being as temptation and thinking as lust, as an example. Or being angry, being tempted to be angry and being angry. So maybe I think about being angry, but I don't choose to pursue anger, then I have not sinned.
So nature and instinct. If you were instinctively a sinner, you wouldn't even be able to think anything else.
Well, and that's the fine line between temptation and whether you have a choice to follow the temptation or not. So all those are permitted, in my opinion, all those are permitted on this side of total depravity. I'm not going to argue against that position. I'm only going to argue against this side. No, it is on subject, but like Steve's question, I'm going to only argue against maybe this portion of the spectrum right here, if total depravity kind of all fits into there, which is you cannot do good at all. That's all I'm going to address. So anything else that you think is other than that, I'll tell you, I think that that's binary. I think you either have free will or you do not have free will. And so anything that you think is on this half of the spectrum is in fact entirely that position. And anything that you think is on this half is what people call libertarian free will. And libertarian free will to me is just another name for free will. I don't see the difference between free will and libertarian free will there. It's a difference without a distinction, distinction without a difference. It's the same thing. I don't understand the difference. Maybe it's my paucity of intellect to get it, but at the end of the day, either you can choose to do right and wrong, or you can't choose to do right and wrong. It's divided down the middle. All right. So only God can change a being's nature. Does anybody, and I will not attack the position, I just want to see if I can put a check mark there. Does anybody disagree with that? All right, so I will not put a check there. So we'll say this one is a questionable, or is one that has not gone unchallenged. All right? If God changed man's nature to a sin nature, now the question is who changed it? So maybe we can say man can change it, maybe the devil can change it. Do you think that man, that somebody other than God changed man's nature? And I won't argue the position, but do you think that somebody other than God changed it? That you can change your nature? So if you have free will, can you change your nature back? Okay. I think, right, I said I wouldn't argue against it. If God changed man's nature to a sin nature, then God created something that does evil by necessity. Now, this is a very loaded term. What I mean to say is, if it is a sin nature, then what you, a sin nature, a total depravity type sin nature, then whatever you do, the evil you do because you have to do it, because it is what you are compelled to do, not because you chose to do it. If that's the case, then God creates something that does evil by necessity. Now, if something does evil by necessity, it doesn't have its own choice as to whether it does evil or not. It's a deterministic being.
Just like a dog going to the bathroom in front of you.
It's just like a dog going to the bathroom in front of you. There's maybe, I wouldn't have chosen that one, but all right. The idea is it's like a gun. It doesn't have, when you pull the trigger on a gun, unless you have the new Verify system coming out to a place near you, please see Skyler's website for anything further on that one.
Checks in the mail.
If you pull the trigger on a gun, because the gun does not have the ability to think, let's say it's an intelligent gun. We've got something kind of from the future that's supposed to select between friend and foe, right? And you can't do blue on blue because it knows the other side. Does it get to choose, or have you pre-programmed it? If this guy has that beacon on him, then you do not shoot. In which case, if some bad guy stole the good guy's beacon, your gun thinks it's a good guy, that kind of thing, right? Is it a deterministic process, or is there actually free will in it? If there's no free will in it, even if it's a fancy, intelligent gun like that, it does not have any moral responsibility when you pull the trigger. You own the moral responsibility. If God makes something that does evil by necessity, that thing does not have moral responsibility. God, in that case, has the moral responsibility because he's the one pulling the trigger. All right, so that would be my point here. Now, I'm going to say, I won't even ask for a vote on this one. I'll say that there are probably people who will question that particular proposition. But in my opinion, if you understand what nature means in the way that I defined it, and you understand what something is by necessity, and you agree that the reason that a gun doesn't have a responsibility for killing somebody is because the gun doesn't have a choice in the matter, we, as human judges, at least put that judgment back on the person. The only argument I can think against this one is to say something like this. Well, you're not allowed to judge God. Okay, that's fair, but it doesn't make it rational, and that's my only point. All right, the next one. God cannot. I say God cannot create something that is evil by necessity, because if God is the trigger puller, then that would make God the author of evil. That the evil that you do, as a being, a totally depraved being, is in fact God's evil that he's doing through you as a robot, deterministic robot slash gun. So no free will, God's the one who did it. And God, being an all good being, by definition, cannot do such a thing. Now this is the part that, unless you're familiar with how the rules of logic work, you may be like, where did that come from? Therefore, human nature did not, now I'm not saying human, that we don't have a sin nature in this statement. What I'm saying is human nature did not change. What I've just said here is it is impossible for human nature to have changed. So what you see here is Humans were created without a sin nature. That's really the only axiom that I'm sticking out there. Is all right, right? I haven't supported that at all. We're just assuming that. This is a law of logic. This right here is a proposition that you're going to have to buy off on if you're going to believe it. But if it does say that, what it means is, it is not possible for any other candidate but God to have affected man's nature. Right, so that means that the only creature we're looking at, the only being we're looking at is God. The creature we're looking at is man. If God changed man's nature to a sin nature, then God did something evil by necessity. I'm making a point about the necessity of the result of evil here. And then I'm saying God cannot, by necessity, by definition, God cannot be responsible for this. So I'm saying it is impossible by 5 that God did 4. And if it's impossible by 5 that God did 4, and God is the only one that could have done it in the first place, then it didn't happen. So this is an argument right here that says man's nature is the same that it was before the fall occurred.
Was it by necessity that God had to allow Satan free will so that the whole definition of love can prevail?
You can run exactly this argument on the devil, minus the change. You can run, the devil was created without a sin. You can say that either the devil was created, you do this way, just pull this one out and say, either the devil was created with a sin, as an evil being or a good being. Only God created the devil's nature. If God created the devil's nature and his nature is to sin, then God created something that does evil by necessity. God cannot create something that does evil by necessity. Therefore, God did not create the devil with an evil nature. It's an argument that is intended to demonstrate free will as a natural consequence of two intersections: God's impossibility of doing evil and the fact that evil exists, which implies, by necessity, in my opinion, I think it's a strong implication to that degree, that there has to be free will. It's the only possible explanation of all this. Now, lest you think that I'm just working free will into it and nobody believes it, everybody. D.A. Carson wrote a whole book about, yes, man's totally depraved, but here's 9 things in Scripture that make it very, very clear that man's also responsible for his actions. And D.A. Carson, who's no slouch as a theologian's, answer is this: I don't understand how they intersect, and nobody does. And that term is called compatibilism. Compatibilism is the viewpoint that this, unlike what I told you, that this is binary, that in fact there's a zone here called compatibility, where you can both be totally depraved and still have free will.
But that doesn't change the binary aspect of it.
Well, they will claim that somehow that zone exists. I say, put the proof out. Their answer is, man's thoughts are higher than God's thoughts, and you don't know everything. Both of which are true. But I don't think it's sufficient. You're saying that compatibilism is conditional on the existence of both?
That's right.
Okay, and if the existence of both is yes. Yes,
so
I agree.
Finding middle ground.
So, I mean, I agree, but I'm not arguing for it. I'm just saying there are people that hold the position.
Is there I don't even know what the concept would be, but is there an inverse, or is there an element inside your suppositions that says that there is another thing that we can't gauge effectively? Like, say, for instance, God creates the sun. But out of the sun, which is an independent body itself, it creates a derivative as your a shadow.
So something that is derivative is not essential to the thing itself. So that is to say, if there was no object other than the sun, there would be no shadows because the sun's light would permeate everything. So this is if no gnat, then no gnat shadow is not something that has to do with the essential nature of the sun. The sun is what it is, regardless of whether or not it casts a shadow. The sun casts light. That which is physical and opaque will then, by the necessity of its own nature, in the presence of light that's from a particular direction, cast a shadow.
Like the moon
Now, that has to do with the essence of light, not the essence of gnat, nor the essence of the sun. So this is why it's really important to find out what is an essential property and what is not an essential property. And that whole Trinity argument that I've been going on about occasionally is all about, it is entirely dependent on what God's essential properties are. If you can't parse what's essentially God's and what's not, then that argument is meaningless.
I think it would be weird if I didn't say anything. So.
Oh yeah. Also, Al is a Calvinist and holds a total depravity condition. So.
I will go ahead and agree that we have total depravity and free will. We freely choose to follow our sin nature, and I don't think I can explain it very well, but. That's, yeah, I agree.
And so Al is a compatibilist. He says both sides. Now, what I would say to Al is, Al, do you think? What do you mean by sin nature? Does man's sin nature make him sin, or does it not make him sin?
It's obviously not mechanistic sense of making us do something, but
at least an influence in that direction.
It's a tough adjective.
So Al did not sign up for a public debate, right? So what I'll say is, what you're hearing is what compatibilism causes you to say. And what I'm saying is, compatibilism is a zone that doesn't exist. So what I want to do is deny the assertion that the sin nature doesn't cause you to sin by necessity, that's not the definition of nature, that you necessarily do what your nature causes you to do. But this is why, note where the disagreement, I'm not going to settle the disagreement here or ask Al to settle the disagreement. I just want to point that this is the disagreement between compatibilism and kind of a binaryism.
So if we didn't have, we've talked about this, I probably hold a minority position on this, but if Adam and Eve did not have something inherent in their nature at the time, they're in what everybody concedes is perfection.
Yes.
If human beings by nature are not going to sin, that's the place where, that is the best laboratory experiment to not sin.
Right.
And we still did.
Right.
So how do you reconcile that with not having what we refer to now as a sin nature inherent in Adam and Eve?
I would say this. If they didn't have the ability to sin, if sin wasn't a 50-50 proposition, let's say, when I say 50, I don't mean, how you want to set, we can set up the priors, so let's do it in a non-Bayesian. Let's just look at it from a naive estimate. The naive estimate of a free will decision is 50-50 either way. So the fact that flipping a coin got you heads instead of tails should in no way surprise you.
Right.
So the fact that Adam and Eve chose to sin should in no way surprise you. It was as likely to be that as it was likely to be the other way from the naive estimate. Now, I think you can go back and say there are some priors in there that ought to inform what that would have been. No, Satan, I don't think it's 50-50.
Okay.
I think there are other factors in there where they've got dictate by authority. They don't have any real temptation to do so. Because remember, if it was just fruit on a tree, if it was just fruit on a tree, they got 1,000 trees in the garden. It wasn't hunger that took them there, is what I'm saying. What it was the desire to know good from evil. Now, why would an innocent person want to know good from evil? Because remember, when he puts them in there and he says, on the day that you eat this fruit, you shall surely die, etc. Satan says what back to them? What was Satan's temptation?
Well, don't worry about it. You'll be like the gods.
What he said was, basically, God is denying you knowledge. Now, God made us to want to learn stuff. And what Satan is saying is, God's denying you knowledge. And God doesn't want you to take this, because then your eyes will be open and you'll be like him, knowing good from evil. You will be like God by sinning. That was the problem with what Satan said. That was the hidden proposition in there. But at the end of the day, the temptation was about being like God. What was Satan's reason for falling? I will ascend to the Most High. I will stand on top of the world, the universe, etc. Satan's wants to be in God's place, and his temptation to man was, you can be like God or be in God's place. Now, what if man had gone back to God and said, hey, this serpent says that I can be like you if I do this? What would God say to them, do you think? You are like me. I made you in my image. What he's asking you to do is to do something that is counter. Your knowledge is less than my knowledge. Over time, I'm going to give you more and more and more knowledge. But you'll never know as much as I know. Are you okay with that? And the answer probably ought to be yes to that. But if you want to know it, I'm happy to tell you. But if, like a kid who says, a five-year-old who says, Dad, I see this movie advertised. I want to go see it. And it's some horrible, horrible movie. Why don't you let your five-year-old see some awful horror slash whatever movie? Why don't you do it? Are you denying them knowledge? I mean, is it because you don't want them to know stuff?
Yes.
Ah, why?
Because it's not good for them.
Ah. Because some knowledge is good and some knowledge is evil. Some knowledge is good and some knowledge is evil. That is to say, the devil may know a lot of things that the innocent people don't know, but that's not desirable knowledge because at the end it doesn't bring joy. So some knowledge brings joy, some knowledge brings sadness. And God's interested in us being happy.
I'm sorry, to go back to that sun concept, and that kind of is like an anti-light, but aren't you implying in that regard that you have knowledge, which is useful, positive, joyful knowledge of what God wants you to have, and everything else, sin being kind of anti-knowledge, it's not really there, it doesn't have an essence in itself, somewhat like a shadow does, and therefore it's not being wrong by saying there is only one side of that, and when you're saying, well, no, that's not a function of the thing, it's a derivative of the thing, I'm saying, isn't that the same application that you could say for knowledge or for what God is telling us that we should have or embody, and it's us that is taking the negative or the anti?
You have tempted me greatly, sir. Because I want to go talk about 3 hours long on something I've been working on about the nature of mathematics because of the terms you used. But let me just say it this way. And this is about knowledge. So here's a graph of knowledge going in this direction. And let's say that these are good things and these are bad things right here. Where you draw the origin defines whether your term is plus, positive, or negative. If you say the zero is here, then the only knowledge that's positive is this one, and any knowledge in this direction is negative. If you say, and why, and in moral terms, do you want anything that's negative? I mean, even we who are evil or do evil, we don't want evil, right? Don't we even say that? Aren't even the people who are doing evil saying, I don't want evil? Very few people are like, I'm evil and I love it and I revel in it. But they're Satanists or something, and they kind of think that's fun. But at the end of the day, they still don't stab each other in the eyeball. Yeah, maybe that's a separate ritual I'm not aware of. If you draw the zero line here, though, everything is positive. This is God's origin. This is God's zero line. This is what Satan was saying the zero line is. Satan lies at the most fundamental level. And the part that I will resist talking about is physics today is messed up. Because mathematics is flawed at the most fundamental level. Okay, more on that later. So let me run through this one real quick. I have two other arguments to run through, and then we can keep coming back to these as much as you want. If there is no single moral choice, think about your own life, any moral choice you've made. If there is no single moral choice that is impossible to do rightly, there's no choice in your life where it was impossible for you to do the right thing, that you had to do the wrong thing, there was no way you could have done the right thing, it's impossible. If there is no single moral choice that is impossible to do rightly, then it is possible to live a perfect moral life. Why is that? Well, if, let's pretend that you lived a very short life and you only made 10 moral choices in there. If each one of them, it was possible to do the right thing. When you do the right thing, let's say you get a score of 1, and when you do the wrong thing, let's say you get a score of 0. If your life is 10 choices long, and you can do right each time, what can you score? what's obvious that you can actually score? A 10. What can you also score?
A zero,
or any number in between. That's all I'm saying. It is the basics of math. It's the basics of counting and addition to make this point right here. This should not be controversial at all. Anybody that thinks this is controversial needs to go back to third grade math. This is going to be controversial. There is no single moral choice that it's impossible to do rightly. Now, if you're going to argue for that, then you have to say what the conditions are that make that impossible, or give me an example from your own life where you literally couldn't have done the right thing. But what's the conclusion here? It is possible, and I'm going to use a different term, to be morally perfect. It is possible to be morally perfect. Now, there's a bunch of implications of this right here. Now, let me tell you, what number of people do you think have been morally perfect? All right, one, we know of one. Do you have any other possible candidates?
Maybe some of the saints.
Okay, like, the only guy I'm gonna even throw in that camp as a possibility, and we know like one line about him in the whole Bible, maybe, is Enoch. Right, so he walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. It sounds like he didn't die, and it seems to me like the penalty for sinning was death, right? But Enoch didn't die, so did God, you know. But you will not see me going out and saying that is the case. I'm not going to say, well, Enoch did it, and therefore. What I'm going to say is, Jesus did it, and therefore. And you'll see my next argument is going to touch on that too. But here's the idea. Most people don't like this conclusion. This was a Pelagian conclusion. It was not Pelagianism, but it was a Pelagian conclusion. It was part of it. And that's declared heresy. So everybody in the Western Church wants to be like, whoa, no, you can't say that. Okay, one, the whole Eastern Orthodox Church says that. And two, if you believe these two things, you don't get a choice. On the pain of irrationality, do you deny this? So you got to pick which one of these you want to disagree with. This is a deductive logical argument. So, last one, let's see if I remember it rightly. I wrote these down and I didn't memorize them well. So if being human now or post-fall means we are totally depraved, and what does totally depraved mean? That we have to do that which is evil by nature, means to be totally depraved, then all born after Adam are, anybody see where this is going? Totally depraved. Jesus was born after Adam. Therefore, Jesus was totally depraved and had to sin by the necessity of his own nature. Now, this is called a reducto ad absurdum. All right, I'm not saying that that's right. What I'm saying is, because that's clearly ridiculous and we know that to be false, then one of these two has to be false. So let's attack the easiest one to be false. Jesus was born after Adam. Well, we got to be more specific, really, right? Jesus was born in the line of Adam and was born with all the same problems that we have today, that he wasn't somehow special in that regard. Does any part of the Bible try to make it very specific that Jesus was born in the line of Adam? Right? We got two gospels that go to, I mean, guys and gals like us, and today, like, why is this? I don't understand why this is important. Why is this relevant? To the Jew, it was very relevant, but also to the philosopher and theologian, it's pretty relevant too. Jesus was a son of Adam. Now, one lineage gives you the lineage possibly through Joseph, and the other one traditionally is through Mary. We don't know that to be the case, but that's why theologians generally say you have two different lineages. There are other explanations, but that's maybe the most common view. If, let's say that, okay, you know what, let's take Joseph out of the equation. Let's put God back in charge. So God, the Holy Spirit is kind of the father side of this one. It was by supernatural intervention that Jesus is in Mary's womb. But why do we give their lineage? That's one question. And the second one is this, and here's the obvious problem. Well, if Mary's the only one involved, then what's the problem still? Mary's totally depraved too. Now, the Catholic Church recognized this. What was the solution for the Catholic theologian? Who was immaculately conceived?
Mary.
Mary, not Jesus. So whenever we hear about immaculate conception, the uninformed Protestant or layperson anywhere else says, well, that's Jesus was conceived immaculately. Mary was conceived immaculately. Mary was conceived specially and specifically, according to the Catholic Church, without sin. She was sinless. So the problem is this. Mary, according to the Catholic Church, never sinned and was a sinless being and a human being. But she also came. So God has to come in and change. God then changed Mary's nature back to not having a sin nature. Now, what's the problem with that kind of... That will work. That will fix this problem. What's the problem with that? Why don't you believe that? There's no biblical warrant for it. And what does it smack of? Oh, you're right. Your argument does lead to this being, but you know what? What if Mary wasn't sin totally depraved? Okay, yes, that would work. Okay, Mary's not totally depraved. That literally is the reason for believing that doctrine. It's not because the Bible says so. It's not because the earthly church teaches that Mary was sinless. Right, but well, what you have to do is have, it would push it back, and you'd end up with an infinite regress, or a regress back to Adam, if you didn't say God came in and basically made Mary specially. But my point is, you could have said that about Jesus. Why didn't the Catholic Church say that about Jesus? Well, it's because if you were born of woman at the time, that was the way people thought of it, if you're born of woman at the time, you come forth with that nature. So it's actually Mary's nature that mattered in that case. So I will point, if you think that's ridiculous, then you need another reason for believing that, you need another reason for countering this argument. So this argument would not fit because this one would be false, this first one. If being human means we're now totally depraved, then all born after that are totally depraved. That assumes God isn't interfering. So the Catholic position is God interfered with that statement and created Mary specially to be sinless. So this argument right here, which I'm going to say reducto so nobody gets it confused after this one. Not Harry Potter reducto. This is Latin reducto. Okay. So I want to look at these three in total and say, what does this suggest about our own nature? And if you can't think of, and you know, look at the ones that are actually controversial. So you want to grant another being godlike power? You're going to have to justify that. You want to say God can do something evil by necessity? You got to justify that because that's not orthodoxy. You want to say that man, that if God creates something that does evil by nature, that's not putting moral responsibility back on God? You got to justify that. So what I'm saying is the naive position on all of these, the first one, the intuitive one, the one that you say that makes sense, when you run this argument, it becomes very clear, if you make those assumptions, that human nature did not change in the fall. It means you do not have a sin nature. Now, is this world broken? Yes. Do you have influence of the sin in your life? Yes. Do you have, go on down the line of all these things? Absolutely. There's no question about that. And this position doesn't challenge that at all. This position does not say, in fact, these are really just arguments for what the Orthodox Church believes anyway. But this position is not counter to the idea that we are sinful, that we are tempted to do wrong, that we do wrong all the time. But one scriptural argument for free will in general, because unless you're going to take a compatibilist position, if you have free will, then these things will end up being true. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I have longed to gather you as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you would not. God himself says, Jerusalem, I would do X, but you would not have me do that. And so I didn't. That is impossible. And guys like Carson and everybody else, and even Piper will say, yep, that's, clearly there's free will there. But, now the question is, but sovereignty, but the verses that talk about election, but these other things. And so my last point, and then we'll get to the last few questions here, is this. There's a position everybody's forgotten about. Most people have forgotten about. And it lies right after this event right here, during something called the Counter-Reformation. And actually, some of this lies here in the Orthodox Church. But in the Western tradition, there's a position that you'll hear called Molinism, that Alfred Molina, a Catholic theologian, was when he was arguing against the children of Luther, so to speak, and saying this Reformation is making some mistakes, here's what they are. He argues against these kind of Calvinistic ideas, and he's not an Arminian. Everybody, Reform guys and gals like to talk about there's Calvinists and there's Arminians and there's nothing else. That's false. There's a whole slew of other people out there. And one of those other people are called Molinists. Molinists are probably the best articulators of what's called middle knowledge, which is how God works free will into all this, which is to say God is still sovereign, but he makes his selection of how he orders the universe, who he puts where, how he creates, all that stuff, based on what he knows his creatures will freely choose to do in those positions. So he preserves free will while still remaining sovereign. That's a topic for another time. But if you're interested in the view that this implies, or a view that is consistent with this, that you might not have heard of, but is actually a really, really good position, it's called Molinism, or it's a position of middle knowledge. By the necessity?
All the billions of people that have lived, Jesus is the only one that never sinned. He's the only one that fulfilled the law, that trusted God perfectly. What is your explanation for that? It's not by accident.
Well, there are two things there, I would say. One, if you raise your hand if you've got kids in this room, or you've raised them significantly as a sisters or brothers or whatever else, what do two-year-olds do? Do they make moral choices? Do they make choices, or do they copy?
Mostly copy.
A lot of what they do is, let's say they do both, but mostly copy, right? My son runs around and says and does stuff. He has no idea what it means, but that's because that's what I do. He's got a little play pan, and he flips the burger in the pan. He has no idea what he's doing, but he saw Dada do it, so he does it. We'll be playing on the couch, and he'll say, "Hang on, be right back," and he runs through the kitchen, and he fiddles with random cabinets in the kitchen, and he runs back to me. Why? Because Dada does that. "Hang on, buddy, I'll be right back." And he goes, and he does clearly random stuff in the kitchen. There's no reason for Dada to have left playing with the truck here, so I don't know what... It doesn't matter what you're doing over there. It's clearly just something random, and he come back. Doesn't understand it, but he imitates it. In a world that is mostly sin, what do we end up imitating?
Mostly sin.
Mostly sin. So why is everybody sinful? Because we live in a broken world. Very simply. And I would say that if this view is true, then the real test would be, and we can't do this test, but the real test would be, a couple in here has a baby, and from the day they have that baby, we whisk him away, and God takes him in his arms, and he raises him in the garden again. So what I'm saying is, there's no sin nature. That baby is going to be just like Adam and Eve. We're all like just like Adam and Eve, but he will have the same choice, the same innocence that Adam and Eve do. Now, I forgot the one other thing I meant to say. This to me is a killer, and I forgot to write this one up there. If being born means you're morally guilty, if being born human means you're morally guilty, and by the way, that's the total depravity position. If being born means you're morally guilty, then all babies go to hell. If being born a human means you're morally guilty, then all babies go to hell. Proposition 2, all babies do not go to hell. Therefore, being born is not the reason you're morally guilty. Does that sound awful to you? What was Augustine's position on this?
Babies go to hell.
Babies go to hell. What's the Catholic Church's position on this? It was limbo, it was purgatory. It's some version of moral punishment for them. Now you'll see writings out of some of the pontifical councils and theological works that say this: we entrust the infants to the mercy of God. What they're saying is, based on what we know, baptism is required. And by the way, Augustine wanted you baptizing babies, and that saves them. Because the Catholic position is the sacrament of baptism is necessary for salvation. If you're not baptized, you're not saved. And but they turn around and make exceptions. Here are martyrs that died without being baptized, but they died in the cause of Christ, and so it is a kind of baptism, and therefore. But You have to, again, you're doing acrobatics to get around it. If you have to do acrobatics to get around it, it's not logically consistent. It either has a logical way to get there or it doesn't. And the bottom line is the Catholic Church's position on this one is it's a mystery. We entrust it to God because it just seems wrong.
Taking this extreme free will position negates the cross because God put in us the ability to get to heaven on our own, so Jesus didn't have to die for us.
Absolutely not. Who in here is perfect? Steve. So Steve is the only one that doesn't need Jesus. He's joking. Steve would be the if Steve were perfect, then Steve would be the only person that doesn't need Jesus. Every Jesus is necessary for all the rest of us.
But there is a select few that don't need Jesus.
Well, if anybody, now I go back to Al's position. Al said, and maybe I agree with him, that nobody was perfect. So if you live, we got 100 moral choices. Somebody lives 99 of them perfectly. But they do the one thing wrong. Do they need Jesus? They still need Jesus, absolutely. And that's what I'm saying. All I'm saying is, I'm saying a person that lives 100 and does 100 wrong, the point was they wouldn't be morally guilty if they didn't have the ability to have done the right thing. Now, again, I want to note something here. You're arguing on the other side, you're arguing a posteriori. You're arguing after the fact. If these right here are true, like this one is true, you have to argue which of these two is wrong. So yeah, maybe it makes the cross unnecessary. It doesn't. I think I explained why. It's necessary for everybody who's ever sinned. But which of these two do you disagree with? So if you don't disagree with one of these two, then you have to agree with this unless you want to be intentionally irrational.
There's no way you can answer this today. So maybe it's the basis for two other classes.
Okay.
God cannot create something that does evil by necessity. It would be interesting to see the logical chain on whether God created evil or evil popped up on its own, how that could happen in God's creation.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's relatively confusing in the face of this argument when you read 5 and you go.
Well, why do you think that, right? Yeah, that's right. And by the way, if 5 is not true, then this argument does not work. But five would have to be true in order for this argument to work. You're right. So if you want this to be justified, now what I would say is, and I'm just going to appeal generally to Orthodox Christianity with a capital O, all Orthodox Christianity. Nowhere in Orthodox Christianity does anybody, even the most rigid Calvinist, make the point that God creates something that does evil by necessity and makes God morally responsible for that. So everybody agrees that God does not, because the Calvinist is a Calvinist because they love the scriptures and they think they read in the scriptures a very clear articulation of total depravity. I think it's a problem of interpretation and a problem of paradigm. But let's grant them why they do what they do. Sorry. Well, let's grant them why they do what they do. But if it's not actually in there, if that's not actually what it means, then they would agree with this statement that evil is not done by God. Because there's a scriptural verse that says, we know God does not do evil, right? Nor is he tempted to do evil. So, yes, sir?
So would you say that maybe our nature is not sinful, but there is something part of us that is, you know, sinful? Because, I mean, the Bible says, surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me.
Right. So, now, when we do that,
something about me that is bent towards.
Where did you read that from?
The Psalms.
Right, and what are the Psalms?
David's letter.
Song lyrics, right? So when, if you're going to, now what I was, and by the way, Paul also, you find that elsewhere, Paul will quote it in some of his writings too, or allude to it in some cases. It's not that stuff like that isn't in there. The question is, does the Bible use hyperbole at all? And I think the answer is very clearly yes. Now, what I will say is, for every verse, and I'll put it this way, and obviously we're running out of time, or we're out of time. If for every verse you can find that says, man, nobody does, and David says it a couple of times, none are righteous, no, not one, or all, everyone has left, and nobody does your will. Is that what the Bible says? Or is David talking about a certain group at a certain time, or is he basically like, we're all a bunch of knuckleheads? You know, when it's a song lyric, one, I'd be careful about pulling theology only out of song lyrics and nothing else without context. Because that David might be horrified that we do that. Two, what is the annunciation to Zechariah and Elizabeth, Zacharias particularly? How are Zacharias and Elizabeth talked about. Who are they? Righteous people following the law blamelessly. Are they righteous? Are they blameless? If you're going to say that a couple, a male and female couple, can't be righteous and blameless, then you have to deny Scripture. Noah, a man righteous before the Lord. Daniel, righteous Daniel. Righteous, Jeremiah talks about righteous Daniel, Noah, and forgetting who the other one is. Elijah. Yeah, but one verse there. But the idea is the number of people, and by the way, David does this too. The wicked, blah, 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 but the righteous, blah, 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 blah. Is he talking about an empty set? No, he's not. He's talking about, Elijah. Lord, I'm the only guy following you at all. Nope, I've reserved for myself, how many? Seven thousands? Seven thousands that have not bowed the knee to Baal. Doesn't mean they're perfect, but the idea is, do you have to be perfect to be righteous?
No.
The answer is no. And maybe with that teaser, we'll go to the next class and I can outline that one. So we've run about 5 minutes over. I do appreciate you listening to me make this argument. The one thing I want to finish on is, we'll continue to address this next time, but as you're wrestling with this and wrestle with it and come back and talk about it next time, remember this. You can't turn around and say, I don't like the conclusion of a deductive argument. You have to say where you disagree with the premises, or you have to show that this either doesn't follow logically or that it's invalid. So figure out where you do that. Thank you for your time.